Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now. But if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic full zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right, betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figured that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie.
All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
And this is what? It's our first full week of Trumplessness.
Yeah.
Right?
I feel the democracy growing back in my bones.
Do you feel like tweeting a hashtag sleep? You read about that, right?
No.
How sleep was trending the day after the inauguration because people were...
Oh, wow. That's not a metaphor for anything like how we got Trump in the first place or being asleep at the wheel or anything like that. Or Sleepy Joe. Is that why it was trending? Because Sleepy Joe?
Maybe. I don't know. It's just like a little tiny bit funny.
It's very funny. Yeah.
But we're back in a space where like a tiny bit funny is okay. We're like, you know, again, this is the post-Trump era. I think we're going to be allowed to have a sense of humor.
Matt is much more of an optimist, I think, about this than I am, which is funny because in general, I would say I'm more of an optimist.
I think that's true. So yeah, so this is the first post-Trump week. The Republic still stands, right?
Of course it stands. I mean, stands taller, stands prouder.
Right. It's standing like a motherfucker now, right?
It's like totally erect as a... Did you hear... Oh, I need to put this in. Did you hear
it's
Chuck Schumer?
Engorged.
Did you hear Chuck Schumer?
No. What did he say?
All right. Speaking of engorged and erect, yeah, it is at attention. It is fully engorged. And no one put this better unintentionally than Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Senators will have to decide if they believe Donald John Trump incited the insurrection against the United States.
I'm so glad I was able to show that to you for the first time.
Oh my God. I wonder how many erection gaffes there have been on the Senate floor. I mean, it can't have been the first, but if it is the first, that's
erection
was an important
history.
Moment.
Yeah, it right? was. Yeah. Well, we should mark them actually and right. give them how many erect penises up. I give that how many
up.
Do we how many up or two erect penises? Is it out of two? Because with golden hairs, when we used to give Biden's stone moments, we would
right.
rate them as
two
per golden hair,
like
right?
way up.
So this
right,
is two yeah. erections way up.
This is two throbbing man shafts way up.
Way up, yeah. Way up for Chuck.
Anyways, a lot of stuff to get to. We have a really interesting guest this week who's going to talk to us about a story that is frankly, one of the weirdest things that's happened in this country in years.
And we couldn't have had a better timing with it, right? We booked it before this broke out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, exactly. And it has nothing to do with, well, it does. It has something to do with everything, basically. Yeah. We're gonna talk about that.
And it's very much his lane.
He's very much in this world. So we're gonna talk about that story, which for those of you who probably haven't guessed yet, it's the GameStop war on Wall Street between Reddit and sort of short selling vampires on the street, and it's a hilarious and like remarkable story on about 90 different levels, and we're gonna talk to writer David Dayan about it, who's been on this story for a while and also is a long-standing financial reporter of some repute, expert on foreclosures. So we're going to get to
and an
some
editor of that at the American Prospect.
Right, exactly. So we're going to talk about all that stuff. But before we do, let's just plow through the four food groups and talk about some of the other stuff that's going on in the world. Katie, what do you have for Democrats Suck?
So for Democrats Suck,
always a tough category, by the way.
I know. Well, it's tough because you don't know what you want to focus on because there's so much. I mean, for Democrats Suck, I may be punting a little bit to David on this one. We're going to have David on to go through the real heavy. He's going to do the heavy lifting. Also, shout out to my man, my friend, Bronco Marchetich from Jacobin, who's written a great piece called Yesterday's Man about Joe Biden. But he I think, summarized this very well when he said, some of Biden's high profile executive orders, the $15 minimum wage for contractors one, or today's one ending Department of Justice contracts with private prisons, are either designed with loopholes or to delay action while making it seem like something is getting done. The drafters added enough hedging in the Dem platform that its word isn't being violated. They support and believe these things, but don't commit to doing them. But this inaction clearly violates Biden's personal campaign platform.
Yeah, what does that sound like? That sounds like every news story from like the last 30 years, right?
So. Oh, yeah. I mean, in that way, America is back to normal, right?
Right.
The new normal. Yeah. Politicians like low-key lying as opposed to overtly lying. And that's really what this nation is about.
Right.
So we're going to get into more of that with David, but I wanted to, for this one, what I wanted to provide you guys with was obvious pandering and also an obvious ripoff of Elizabeth Warren's big structural Bailey. So we now have a Twitter account. Dan, can you show the Twitter? And it's called the Oval Pawfis.
Oh, boy.
And it's the Oval Pawfis, and it's Pawfishal Office of SCOTUS and CODUS, the fan page for Champ, Major, and Winston Biden. First Dogs USA on Instagram, Yappy Hour spot on the Republic.
I can't get mad at this.
I mean,
I'm gonna go ahead and disagree with you on this.
Is this the dog that made Biden break his foot, fracture his foot, or something?
I don't know. Did he?
Which one's Major? Yeah, he fell. Remember something that like got covered up, but he fractured his foot. I sound like it got covered up. I don't mean covered up like it didn't happen, but it was barely.
You sound like Alex Jones.
I know.
He was drinking fluoride out of the faucet, and then he tripped over his dog, and right.
But they wouldn't talk about it.
That's right.
No one will tell you that but me. All right, so you don't think this Democrat? I just think this is a good example of how they're going to try to distract us with bread and circus and puppies while they do nothing.
I mean, I'm in favor of bad puns, like the worse the better, frankly.
Well, this one is, we're so excited and we just can't hide it. We're about to lose pawn troll.
Okay, that's not even a pun.
And we think we like it. Oh my God, this is even worse. It's we're so excited and we just can't hide it. We're about to lose Pontrol and we think we like it. That's a Pointer Sisters.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
Pointer Sisters. See, I'm better at this than they are.
Oh, the Pointer Sisters. Oh, but they didn't even go for that joke.
I know. This is like a parody of me. Like, I don't get this bad with puns. In fact, I think you and I should be, if you want to hire us.
I think your puns are actually quite
they're
good.
They're good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, none of this. I mean, I know we're supposed to just be pawning over all of this.
See, that actually makes sense.
It's so much better than pawntastic.
Pawning, what pawning.
They just sound like they have some weird Boston accent the way that they write it out, right?
That's not even a Boston accent. That's just random. It's not even random. Those aren't even jokes. Wow, I can't believe how rapidly I changed my mind about that one. I was You don't have to go overboard with it. You know what I mean?
But Dan and Matt, you got, just look at this. Hold on. This is a great combination of everything that's wrong with the Dems. So this is another one. As our dad POTUS was on the phone with Vladimir, we had a few woofs of our own with the pawdorable Pasha, Vernie, Yume, and Buffy. We asked them to pawn Vince, their father, to stop doing evil things to good humans and to free Alexei Navalny.
God.
They promised they'll try their best. Okay, this is so off. Matt, can you describe it? You're better at, I mean, whatever. It's Putin in a snowsuit.
It's Putin rolling around in a snowsuit with at least two dogs. But they're like mixing Russiagate with dog puns. I'm obviously not pro-Putin on this whole Navalny thing, but
it's not even a coherent narrative.
I know.
It's like, I mean, in a way, I like it. It's much less belligerent. Do they think they're going to kind of aw shucks their way into changing Putin on certain things? Like,
no, this is like all just red meat for people who...
For resistance libs?
Yeah, exactly, who just gorge themselves on SNL.
Right.
You know, features about Putin coming down the chimney and stuff like that.
But what's weird is that, like, and actually that's kind of on brand because he's wearing red and white and in the snow right now in this
image. Yeah,
but like,
exactly.
What's weird is it just makes Putin look like not. Human. Yeah, it doesn't make him look evil. He's playing around in the snow and makes him a human, which is why I'm like, maybe this is their diplomacy as opposed to.
Are they reaching
out through the dogs?
No.
All right. No. Anyway, it is ridiculous. It's weird. But we asked them to pawn Vince, their father, to stop doing evil things to good humans and to free Alexei Navalny. They promised they'll try their best. But isn't that, I would be like a little weirded out and offended if I were Navalny. Because isn't that kind of like jokey for.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I would love it if you sent a couple of tank divisions, but instead you're gonna tweet a picture of Putin rolling around in the snow with his dogs, but whatever. You know what this is? It's a pretty bad offense against humor. I would say, because like there's only like most people think that making no jokes is being humorless.
No,
but actually being humorless is doing this. Is sticking your hands where your paws in this muck and trying to make jokes where you really shouldn't. Anyway, that's bad. That's a bad start for the Biden administration, humor wise. All right, I guess we should move on Republicans suck. Some stuff to, I guess, choose from this week. I did want to point out, and this is not, people are going to call this a cop out because it's not directed at the right Republicans. But Dan, if we could see the announcement for the Republican Accountability Project, there was an announcement this week that they're going to create a new thing called the Republican Accountability Project, which is going to spend $50 million basically on messaging against, you know, sort of the wrong Republicans and in favor of the right kind of Republicans. And guess who is on the board of this, if you look down. So it's Bill Kristol, basically, is running this thing. And for me, this is it's pretty clearly an echo of this thing that happened. So during the 2015-2016 election, there was the, Democrats hired Fusion GPS,
right.
You know, this service to investigate Trump. And that started a lot of the sort of Russiagate stories, which in turn grew into this thing called the Democracy Integrity Project, which supposedly had $50 million in funding to help advance stories about, you know, sort of Russia-related Trump offenses. This looks like it's actually a continuation of the same theme, the Republican Integrity Project. It's basically the same concept where they're going to spend a lot of money sort of propagandizing what they call principled Republicans. And then they're going to do a lot of things that are directed at people who are going to be talking about the electoral fraud or whatever the latest Republican conspiracy is, which a lot of people are going to say, oh, well, great. Except that it's what they're really trying to do here is sort of replace the Republicans with their version of Republicans, which are Bill Kristol and Lincoln Project types.
Right. Would you call him an architect? An architect of the Iraq War?
Absolutely. He was the, I would say he was the intellectual progenitor of the whole thing. Like he way back in 1996, for people who don't remember this, he wrote this article in Foreign Policy magazine where he proposed this theory of what he called benevolent hegemony. And the idea was that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Americans needed to resist the temptation to cash in the so-called peace dividend. And instead of spending less on defense and spending more at home to sort of rebuild society, we should instead rapidly expand our influence even more and make sure that there are no countries out there left that aren't under our domain or dominion. So the whole concept was we shouldn't allow any countries that aren't under our control. He sort of lobbied against what he called Armand Hammerism, which was trying to have a relationship with a non-allied country.
Right.
We should just control other countries. And then he used that as an argument a couple of years later to say we have to get Saddam Hussein out of Iraq. This was in 1998. And then all of that language ended up being used as part of the Bush administration's argument for getting out of for regime change a couple of years later. So he was sort of the person who invented the regime change idea.
Right, which is why we definitely want him to be the face of the Republican Party.
Right, which is, and it's so amazing that this guy and guys like him and David Frum are now back in the good graces of, you know, sort of upscale, upper class liberals who just, you know, a couple of decades ago were thinking these people were like Satan incarnate.
Not even a couple, let's say where we were 2020. I mean, I would say 10 years ago,
Ten years ago, maybe even.
I would say up until like through Obama years.
Through 2008 for sure.
These people have been, they're MSNBC Republicans, right?
They've been completely rehabilitated and it's been such a rapid transformation too, because it's like a faulty syllogism. It's like, okay, well, these guys don't like Donald Trump, therefore they're good. It doesn't work like that. They can be actually horrible people too.
Right. And what if they dislike him for the wrong reasons also, right?
Right. And this whole thing, I mean, like the Lincoln Project was pretty clearly conceived as a way to it's like a hustle, basically.
Grift.
To squeeze.
That word is overused, but in this case, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's.
But in this case, it's appropriate.
Yeah, it's playing on the fantasies of you know, sort of anxious, upscale Democrats to give money to their idea of what responsible republicanism is. And they squeeze a significant amount of cash out of that. And now this is another one of those schemes. And these guys who were, you know, they were monsters. Like the stuff that they came up with during the Bush years, you know, in support of everything from invading Iraq to creating, you know, secret assassination regimes and all that, and torture and everything else. Now they're all fine again. They're all welcome back in polite society, and that's cool. I just don't get this. Like, you know, some of it is people who aren't old enough to remember, I guess, but most of them are. Aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, Rick Wilson, we've focused on him on this show. He's an absolutely terrible person. I'll say that. You don't have to co-sign that. I just want to give a shout out to Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II, who I really want to have on the show, by the way. He's behind the Moral Mondays movement, mm-hmm. and the Poor People's Campaign. He's really mm-hmm. great. And I don't know why he did this, but he went after the Lincoln Project yesterday, or January 26th. He said, talking heads must not call it the Trump base. It's the Republican base. And even though those now in the Lincoln Project must admit that for years as Republicans, they participated in pouring the gasoline. Trump just lit the match. He didn't create the division and pour all the fuel. Project Lincoln, are you for restoring the Voting Rights Act? Are you for health care for all, living wages, just immigration law, justice for indigenous people? If not, then you must admit your policy positions are the same ones as the GOP has used for over 50 years to divide the country. Trump inherited the division many Republicans created, and he exploited it all the way to violence.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is that when you get scratched the surface on what the policy beliefs of all mm-hmm. these people are, you know, it's aggressive, democracy promotion, you know, interventionist foreign policy,
right.
Corporate deregulation, you know, to the extreme. And, you know, their only virtue is that they're not Q followers,
right.
And they don't believe in stop the steal and everything like that. So it's really unfortunate that that these folks are coming back, but it's part of this whole memory erasing campaign where we just forget the stuff that we cared about before 2016, from everything from surveillance to, right. Income inequality to everything else. Right. And we're going to talk about some of that today with David, but you know, a lot of these issues just got during the Trump years. We're back in this place where we can talk about something else now. And,
right.
We don't need to be bringing these folks in, but whatever. But I went on long enough about that. So what do we have for Isn't That Terrible this week?
So for Isn't That Terrible, we have a trigger warning to anyone who's doesn't like cannibalism. But we have,
is that really legit? I mean, are there really people who don't like cannibalism?
I mean, you know what? I don't want to normalize cannibal phobia. You're right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, you gotta be careful.
Gotta be careful, yeah. And I mean, to be fair, look, I'm not pro, as listeners and viewers know, I've kind of carved out a philosophical moral space to interrogate necrophilia. But like this, I don't have anything, there's nothing good about this. This is kind of a story within a story. So reading at the New York Post, which is always a great place to look at this stuff, cannibal cop Gilberto Valle Gilberto Valle I don't know what his ethnicity is. I don't know if he's if
can
it's
we see that headline?
Portuguese. Cannibal cop Gilberto Valle dishes on Army Hammer scandal. The former NYPD officer whose fantasies about kidnapping, killing, and eating women stripped him of his badge and landed him in a jail cell doesn't have any advice for Army Hammer. But he's grateful to pass the torch. Army can carry the cannibal fetish mantle now, cannibal cop Gilberto Valle told the Post on Friday when asked about the Hollywood star's fiendish fantasies that allegedly include barbecuing his girlfriend and eating her ribs. The situation with me has been over for years now, and I'm trying to move on with my new life. It's so exhausting to keep being a punchline. Valle, now 36, was accused of attempted kidnapping in 2012 after his wife discovered reams of cannibal porn and detailed plots to eat her and other women on his computer and reported him to NYPD. Awkward. Soon, his quiet suburban life was shattered and he found himself on trial, desperate to convince a jury. His love of flesh was nothing more than a sick fantasy. In 2013, he was convicted of the crime, but the following year, a judge overturned the sentence, agreeing with Valle that sick thoughts were not a crime.
It's weird that I just mentioned Armand Hammerism in the previous segment.
I know. I know. Hammer, who was unlikely to end up in jail, is experiencing a similar fall from grace. Leaked DMs allegedly sent by the Call Me By Your Name movie star read like a Hannibal spinoff and include cannibalistic cravings like cutting off a woman's toe and keeping it in his pocket. Since the scandal broke, he's decided to step away from his role in Shotgun Wedding with Jennifer Lopez and even had to slash the price of a home. I know. He's selling by a whopping $800,000. Valle couldn't help but relate. In general, people in all walks of life have unusual fantasies or they'd never want to, that they'd never want to have made public. Just because you're a cop or an actor, I like that combo, doesn't mean you're immune from being aroused by something that isn't as mainstream as other stuff.
Right?
There are plenty of people who would be mortified if their friends and family knew what they were into. And that's just the way it is. Still, the stink of flesh is hard to wash off.
Nice.
Said. And while he's not sure what'll end up happening to Hammer, he's definitely ready to stop talking about his past. I don't really have any thoughts on it. I don't know if he could be facing legal trouble or if it's just a kink shaming I'm settled into my restarted life with new friends, all of that. And I don't want to resurface with that nightmare again. It's embarrassing and it takes a toll on me, he said while talking to the New York Post. Okay.
Right. Yes, exactly. Jokes aside, there is sort of kind of an issue here, which is, can we really criminalize your most inner, screwed up thoughts? I don't think I've ever actually fantasized about eating a person, but...
Well, what about... Yeah, sure, but that's an easy... That's very, very black and white issue, but the shades of gray come in when it comes like this. Have you ever asked someone or wanted to ask someone if they could cut your toe off and keep it in their pocket?
I've probably done that. No,
who hasn't, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to cut off one of your toes and keep it with me in my pocket, so I always had a piece of you in my possession.
You want to just be closer to the person.
Yeah, right? I mean, he's trying to build a relationship. Look, a lot of men have intimacy issues and are commitment phobes. And then what does this guy do? He asks to carry a piece of you with him the time. He wants to never be separated. He's really overcoming a lot of boundaries, fears of being controlled.
Now it's mixed messages.
Yeah. Now, what are men supposed to do? Seriously. Right? Damned if you do ask someone to cut off, say something that you'd like to cut off their toe and keep it with you. But also, there is a difference between like planning to do that.
Right.
And saying you want to do that. Now, look, it's not my thing. Just like I find necrophilia disgusting. But maybe I am going to have to start speaking truth to power about this too. And for people who haven't seen, aren't longtime viewers and listeners to the show, you know, my thing is that it started out, it was not a plan. Matt shared a story about a police officer who molested a corpse.
Opportunistically.
It was during the height of the George Floyd protests. I kind of thought to myself, without thinking, wow, well, if we're going to have police brutality, wouldn't it be great if it happened to corpses and not living people?
Right.
And from there, and the rest, as they say, is history. And now I'm really thinking about what the ramifications of that kind of out of the box thinking will be on cannibalism. So I'll get back to you.
No, I mean, I think you raise important points. I mean, yeah, would you shun somebody just because, I don't know, you discovered something on their computer saying like, I want to eat Cheerios out of Katie's head or something like that. I mean,
that's funny because that describes how my last relationship started. I would probably not want to be friends with them, much less date them. But I don't know if I would, unless I felt in danger of like, unless I had a fear that they legit were going to do like to my head what they did in The Man with Two Brains.
Oh, the cranial screw top.
Yeah. If I thought someone would do that to me in order to put Cheerios in it, then yes, I would tell the authorities. If not, I would maybe tell my friends, probably. Right. Girl, don't date him. He wants to eat Cheerios out of your head.
All right. So isn't that weird? There are actually a couple of things. There was a story we missed that I just wanted to bring up quickly because I saw it in a list of another year-end list of weirdest stories. And I can't believe that we missed this, but Dan, can you call up the Madonna has donated so much money that she may legally become the EU's newest member? So Madonna pledged $1 million last year during an online summit held by the EU Commission, aimed at raising money to research coronavirus vaccine development and produce tests. And somebody joked that she had now qualified to become a member state of the European Union online. And as a result, several serious news agencies actually thought that was true and did news stories on that subject. So what we're looking at is a story from The Independent that has a serious headline that Madonna might become part of the European Union.
Oh my God. It's like the Vatican 2.0.
So if we could just look at the lead sentence here, this is pretty funny. As if 2020 wasn't weird enough already, Madonna may end up replacing the United Kingdom as a member state of the European Union. Because of an obscure EU law unearthed by Politico's Paul Dallison, Madonna can join the organization because she pledged more money to fight coronavirus than several of its actual members. So that's actually not true, but you know, it's one of those fake news stories that got through last year. We forgot to mention it. The other really quick one, and this is a more of a classic story of a theme that's always satisfying. Sort of right-wing conservative politician gets caught in embarrassing sex situation. Dan, if we could see the Hungarian MEP admits he was in a lockdown orgy. Okay, a senior MEP from Hungary's ruling Fidesz party admitted Tuesday that he took part, this is back from back in December, that he took part in a lockdown party described by local media as an orgy that was broken up by Brussels police. Jozef Sager said in a statement that he was present at the private party, at which, according to the Belgian press, police found 25 naked men, including an MEP and a number of diplomats. According to a press release from the public prosecutor's office, quote, a passerby reported to the police that he had seen a man fleeing along the gutter. He was able to identify the man. The man's hands were bloody. It is possible that he may have been injured while fleeing. Narcotics were found in his backpack. The man was unable to produce any identity documents. He was escorted to his place of residence, where he identified himself as SJ by means of a diplomatic passport. He talks about how, you know, he's, quote, sorry, and then he, quote, deeply regretted breaking COVID restrictions. Quote, it was irresponsible on my part. I am ready to stand for the fine that occurs. So he apparently was on the sort of conservative side of against some LGBTQI type bills,
right?
Which makes this particularly funny,
Rich. Right? Yeah, I'm looking at the Hungarian government has cracked down on LGBTQI rights, and last week, along with Poland, voiced strong opposition to a gender equality plan for EU foreign policy that seeks to bolster women's, girls, and LGBTQI rights worldwide by challenging gender norms and stereotypes.
Let's just put it this way. You probably want to keep mum about all kinds of issues if you're going to get caught with bleeding hands leaving a scene with 25 naked dudes.
Right. And we are so excited to be bringing on a friend of the show. He's been on my show a bunch. I know, Matt, you've talked to him a bunch. David Dan, executive editor of The American Prospect, author of Monopolized Chain of Title, also the author of the Unsanitized newsletter, only at prospect.org, and a great investigative journalist.
Yeah, and I first encountered his work back during the financial crisis when he was working on the stuff that eventually became the book Chain of Title. And he was really one of the only people in the country who actually wrote about the foreclosure crisis, which was, you know, affected millions of people. And it was for all intents and purposes, kind of a non-story in the rest of the media universe. And he really got into the nuts and bolts of how it all worked, why robo-signing was bad, like how people got kicked out of their houses unfairly, how mistakes were made, all these other things. And so he did a very thorough job of sort of tracing, especially with a lot of case histories, how that worked. But anyway, we're going to talk to him about some other stuff, including the insane GameStop story, which he's been tweeting about lately. So let's talk to Dave Dan. David, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Been a fan for a long time. Obviously, you and I have known each other for a long time, dating back to the whole foreclosure madness, and a huge admirer of your book, Chain of Title. And we want to get into some of that, too, because some of those issues are resurfacing in a big way with the COVID situation. But first, we thought we would sort of take advantage of your financial expertise to help walk us and Katie and our audience through this crazy news story that somehow it's suddenly all over the news involving a company called GameStop. Can you help just sort of give people the basics of what this news story is?
Sure. So GameStop is a retailer that it's kind of like a retail storefront outlet. And, you know, like most retailers right now, it doesn't have a great business. It's not doing terribly well. And as a result, the stock was really suffering. But it turns out that there are a ton of bored people during this pandemic, and a lot of them are, you know, shitsters, for lack of a better word. And they have gotten together in these various groups. There's a Reddit subgroup called Wall Street Bets, and they've decided almost on a lark. It's almost like 4chan for the capital markets. They've just decided to bet up a bunch of these stocks. And one of them is GameStop, and it's kind of the most prominent of the genre. And what they're doing is sort of a counterattack to what a lot of hedge funds do, which is something known as short selling, where you're actually betting that a stock will go down. And with respect to GameStop, these guys have all gotten together. They're all, you know, day traders now. There's this app that makes it really easy called Robinhood. A lot of them are involved in that. And they have decided, you know what? We're actually going to bet the stock up. And in the process, they're screwing over these large hedge funds that have very large short bets on companies like GameStop. So this is this hedge fund called, Melvin Capital?
Melvin Capital, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. that has lost like $3 billion this week. Which is so amazing.
It totally is. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, so much so that other hedge funds are coming to the rescue of Melvin Capital and just trying to prop it up. And it's just like, I mean, I did do some tweet about this where you know, imagining a hedge fund guy saying, hey, you can't just get a bunch of people together and distort the capital markets. That's our job. That's what we're supposed to be doing. You're not allowed to do that.
So they got played basically at the game that they usually play other people at?
Basically, I mean, sort of, yes.
That's a pretty good summary. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it kind of shows the complete artifice of the stock market in general. It sort of just reveals it as nothing more than a gambling hall, not based on economic fundamentals in any real way. I mean, maybe sort of glancingly, but it shows that you can just sort of pump up a stock. I mean, what's funny is that our Wall Street is kind of reinventing the pump and dump scheme that you know, financiers from time immemorial have taken advantage of to loot the markets, and they're just doing it with a Reddit and a new app. So that's kind of my sense of it. It just shows like the Potemkin village that is the New York Stock Exchange.
And it's become this amazing class thing also, right? Because it's a bunch of sort of random, mostly younger users in these Reddit groups taking on kind of entrenched, already rich, credentialed Wall Street gamblers, right? And
the only difference, like, that's literally
absolutely
only difference between these two is that, you know, I have a seat on the exchange, whereas this guy has an app, but we're both doing the same, you know, robbing of the public markets.
Right. Or if anything, the hedge fund guys are less legit because they're not even necessarily gambling with their own money. But the public perception that it's this group of, you know, kind of celebrated, credentialed Wall Street professionals who are going to suffer like the tortures of the damned because they're in this terrible position. The Schadenfreude factor is pouring more people into the market. Like, that's become a market factor, right? It's drawing people from all over the world to bet this stock up. And what is it? It's like, last time we checked, it was at the beginning of the show, it was 350 or something like that. And it started at what, 7?
I mean, you hear the term Occupy Wall Street, and this is actually it.
Like, exactly.
This is what it means to occupy Wall Street, is you beat them at their own game. And it shows that brute force is a factor in the markets. And, you know, that was what hedge funds used through the power of their own capital to their advantage. But now you have this accumulated capital from thousands of day traders, not tens of thousands, who can just use that brute force right back. It's one of the most satisfying moments of the last decade. It's really amazing.
How can we leverage that for good?
I'm sure once people realize the genie's out of the bottle now that this can happen. So I'm sure there will be people who will organize different ways to apply the lesson of GameStop. But, you know, for right now...
Well, I mean, it's happening in other... GameStop is not the only stock where this is happening.
Right.
AMC Theaters having to. I saw Tootsie Roll, which who knew Tootsie Roll was a stock, like a publicly traded stock? But it is. It has the code TR. It's like from 1906, and that was up 50% today.
Awesome.
So you know, it's really unbelievable, and you know. What I'm trying to game out is what is going to be the trade group pushback, like on the Hill, to like try to get this stopped somehow. You know, like what is going to be the legislation that they're going to ask for to stop people from doing, you know, to confine the practice of pump and dump schemes only to sophisticated people rather than
right.
unsophisticated people. I don't know what they're going to ask for.
Well, I mean, that's a serious question because you can bet that there are going to be calls for like regulation of these Reddit rooms, right? Maybe there'll be some kind of a barrier that like a, you know, the non-governmental regulatory agencies, right? Well, maybe they'll increase the barriers for trading activity, which I can't imagine that the day trading companies will assent to that.
But it's like once it starts, where do you stop it? Like what right. you're really saying is there shouldn't be high frequency trading, right? Like at all,
right.
like because there are these risks involved. Well, if that's the case, then all of the strategies that hedge funds have used to massively ramp up their takeaways and their profits go away too. So like, where do you stop it? Like that's what's going to be hilarious about it because they're going to draw this really artificial line as to who is allowed to engage in these strategies.
Exactly. And I mean, the other clearly funny thing about this, and this is like less, actually, it's actually less funny, but there's an element of like, you know, sort of French Revolution anger here because the guys who are short sellers, they're essentially trying to put companies out of business. And there's probably some anger towards, well, here are these Wall Street pirates who are trying to take away a bunch of retailer jobs and let's just stick it to them. Let's put them out of work, you know? And there's a real class warfare element to that that could get pretty ferocious, I would imagine.
I mean, it's not often that a company is so perfectly tied to its name. And Robin Hood is literally showing that right now. Like they are literally trying to take from the rich and give back to, you know, working class people.
And the other funny, the other thing about this, I think it may be lost a little bit on people who don't follow these things a lot is the unique dynamic of why these guys are so vulnerable, which is that when you make a short bet, like if you bet long on a company, if you invest $20 in a, you know, in a stock and it goes down, the most you can lose is $20. But if you bet against the company, right. your losses can be infinite because as people bet up the stock, you actually have to end up replacing all of that cash that you borrowed to borrow those shares. And so as they bid it up into these fantastic dimensions, as it goes from 70 to 7 to 350 or whatever it is, these guys are going looking at, you know, it creates $1 billion losses, you know, not just million dollar
yeah,
ones.
So that's exponential. And there's a whole business that accommodates short selling. And you've written about it, Matt, very well. It's called securities lending. There are these counterparties now that are going to be potentially affected by this run up in these various stocks because they have to, you know, find a way to grab the stock so they can pay it back. You know, I mean, they're essentially, you know, in some cases they're, you know, what's known as naked shorts on the stock they don't actually own at the time. And so they have to, if they get a call, they have to actually go get that stock. And that's what this business model, like the sort of ancillary businesses is based on. So, you know, what's going to happen there? Like, how is this going to cascade out? You know, is going to be really interesting.
Isn't that another aspect of this that's kind of pulling the curtain back on, you know, the absurdity of how Wall Street normally operates? Like people are, they're seeing that there really isn't a whole lot to this. Like all the myths about how the expertise of traders, it is kind of bullshit in the end, right? But also they're seeing like that there are lots of practices on Wall Street that are more than a little sketchy. Like there are way too many of these shares in circulation. There are more shares being traded than actually exist, which is like prima facie proof of that naked shorting concept, which they long poo-pooed as, you know, a myth that never happened. But clearly, there's at least a little bit of that going on. right now.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the other thing that I think is really funny is that you have all this concern among market participants for the fact that something is going up. Oh no, this is not what we wanted. Something is actually gaining in market value. We can't have this.
Anyway, we're going to see what happens with this crazy GameStop story. It'll go somewhere.
Shifting gears a little bit, David, you at the American Prospect wrote a really great piece that's called The Day One Agenda. The next president can use laws already on the books for constructive change without abusing executive power. And you kind of lay out all the things that the Biden administration can get done without needing new legislation. And then you have a more recent piece that you wrote, Biden's executive actions just scratch the surface, implementing congressional laws is massively important to make progress, and Biden has the ability to go further. So could you kind of outline where Biden has gone, where he could go, and anything else?
I'll be able to talk more with a little more specificity about this in the coming weeks, because we're going to put together a tracker of all of the executive actions that we recommended in our series, which was like 40 articles of things that Biden could do, or any president could do, without new laws, basically based on existing statutes. And we came up with, there's something like 77 different actions that we thought would be pretty impactful. And just to give you a preview, Biden has done like, I think 11 in part, or all of those actions. So some of them, you know, he's certainly reversing some bad Trump stuff. There's some positives to take away there. Other things kind of look good on the surface, but once you just sort of look underneath, it's not so much. So one example is Biden decided to restore an Obama era executive order that ends contracts with private prison companies.
Right.
So private prisons, you know, manage and operate corrections facilities for the federal government at certain federal facilities. However, it's not really that widespread in the prison realm. About 9% of all federal prisoners are in privatized facilities. However, if you look at immigration detention, there's a fantastic amount of privatization there. About 72% of ICE detainees are in privatized facilities. So, you know, the Biden team and the Obama team before him had two choices. They could say, let's end all contracts through the Department of Justice on private prisons, or let's end all contracts with the Department of Homeland Security on immigration detention. And of course, Biden did the former, which is the least obtrusive of these, which is to just end the DOJ contract. The Homeland Security contracts continue, and that's the majority of the where the private prison is getting its revenue from these days, is through immigration detention. So that's an example of one that's just sort of not what meets the eye. It's a good signal to say we're going to cancel all these DOJ contracts, but you know, it's not really where the money is.
I mean, isn't that, how much of that is like, oh, it's good, but not far enough, versus, not that we can get into their people's heads, but versus like, we're going to do this little thing and then we check off a box and now we don't have to do that bigger thing.
Yeah. I mean, the constraint on doing the bigger thing, of course, is that there's so much privatization in immigration detention that if you cut off those contracts, you actually couldn't, you would not be able to detain a whole lot of people, at least not right away, without spinning up a massive amount of infrastructure within DHS. And they don't want to do that. You know, that would cost money, even though, of course, the contracts cost money. But,
right.
You know, this is the dumb way that we deal with, you know, public and private resources. We think it's somehow better to privatize a service, contract it out, That company then has to get a layer of profit out of it. So it could end up either costing more or they massively cut the labor in order to get that layer of profit and make a
or bet. Safety or services.
Right. Yeah. And they just make it abjectly worse.
Right.
But that's considered more efficient than actually just distributing or producing whatever the resources yourself. I think that Biden and Obama before him thought, oh, well, we have to be able to do immigration detention, so we can't cut that. I think that's sort of where we're at with that one as concerned. Another one was the permitting and leasing on oil and gas of oil and gas and coal leases on federal land. So Biden put in a moratorium on new leases, not new drilling, new leases. And of course, at the end of the Trump administration, there was a feeding frenzy of leases because they knew this was coming. So oil and gas companies leased like a tremendous amount of public land right at the end. And none of that would be affected by this new order, which is just says we can't do any new leases for a short period of time, an indeterminate period of time. They might end up leasing after that.
It's not specified how long it's going to be?
No, it's a review. It's a 60-day review, but it does not say that they're not going to do it after the end of that 60 days. It's unclear. So that's another example where it's a question. There's some statutory stuff, and there'll probably be a court case around this, but it does seem like you could just end all new and existing leases on federal land. But that's not the that would be a more aggressive tactic. And of course, Biden has said that I'm gonna color inside the lines, which is to say I'm not going to do anything that upsets anybody with these executive orders.
Yeah.
What about the eviction moratorium? You wrote a little bit about that, I think. They just continued that, and the Trump's right. version of that.
There's an eviction moratorium that was put out by the CDC. It's actually as a public health measure, which is true, right? I mean, you don't want to put people on the street when they're supposed to be, socially distancing and things like that. But that order really is very focused on non-payment of rent. Like you can't kick somebody out for non-payment of rent, but other measures could be used as a context for eviction. So if it's not breaking terms of the lease, loud music, like all of these things. And what we've seen around the country is that landlords will spin up some context, some pretext to get people evicted. And there have been thousands of evictions under this old order. So a lot of housing advocacy groups have said, hey, instead of just passing, extending the old order, let's actually tighten up this language so that nobody gets evicted rather than, giving landlords a loophole and a way to get people out of various properties. And that's not what they did. They just extended the CDC order. It creates the same situation we're seeing now. The other problem is there's no enforcement for this. So like if a state decides we're going to open up our housing court and we're going to just process evictions, even though there's a federal moratorium, there's not really anyone in the federal government that's assigned to say you can't do that. And so we've seen, from the very first eviction moratorium that was in statute under the CARES Act, we've seen evictions because, these states just decide not to comply and there's nobody really holding them accountable for not complying.
And it seems like the measure as constructed, I think you wrote about this, is it benefits kind of sort of large corporate landlords who have like an institutional way to claim that people are being evicted for some other reason.
Yeah, it benefits them in a few ways. I mean, one is that they have large legal staffs that they can find the loophole that they need to find. The other way is, so there's like money for rental assistance. This was in the CARES Act and is actually in the more recent bill in December. The way that money works is it goes directly to the landlord. So it doesn't pass through the individual. It's supposed to, cancel balances, outstanding balances and things like that. But the landlord has a role to play into actually securing that rental assistance. And so if you have a large corporate landlord versus a mom and pop, who's going to have more sophistication to be able to access that billion, multi-billion dollar pot of money from the federal government that's been given, you know, for the purpose of rental assistance? Obviously, the corporate landlords are going to be able to grab that money. So there are a whole lot of ways where it's kind of the playing field gets tilted. And Matt, you know, in writing about the foreclosure crisis, that there was this cottage industry that built up with these landlords. Like, it was private equity firms, basically, on Wall Street that decided to get into the rental business in a way that they weren't before the financial crisis. So all these foreclosed homes were inventory around the country. They would come in with billions of dollars of capital, scoop them up, very hastily renovate them to make them presentable, at least at first glance, and then rent them out, sometimes to the same people who were foreclosed upon, right? Like, so there was this boom in single family rentals, and there it's now like an asset class, like it's a business that never existed before the financial crisis. Invitation Homes, which is part of Blackstone, Stephen Schwarzman's giant private equity firm, has about 80,000 homes. Blackstone still has a stake in it, but they spun it out and went public. More recently, there's a company that's private equity owned called Progress, and they bought up one of the leading competitors. So now they've built an inventory of about 55,000 homes. They're the second largest one of these single family rental companies. But the fear is that post-pandemic, after you get through the foreclosure moratorium, after you get through the eviction moratorium, maybe mom and pop landlords are unable to stay afloat because they aren't getting a lot of revenue back, that you're going to see these large corporate landlords grab even more inventory and get even bigger. And, you know, I mean, 80,000 homes doesn't sound like a lot, but they're only in like six locations. They concentrate their purposes in cities and get a large share of the outstanding inventory in that city. And then they can move rents. They can, you know, they can become the market essentially rather than moving with the market. So it's very concerning. And it's more concerning that the federal government orders like this eviction moratorium are almost facilitating these corporate landlords.
And what about the minimum wage increase, which is going to go into effect in 2025, I believe?
There are a couple different things that we're talking about. So Bernie Sanders and a bunch of people introduced a bill to increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025. And, you know, that's somewhat common to these minimum wage bills. They have a ramp up period. Sure. What Biden did, and actually I think this is one of the good things, is that he said that all federal contractors, as a condition of getting the contract, have to pay their workers $15 an hour, which is just like, you know, we talk about this in the Day One Agenda, that the procurement authority, the fact that the federal government is a big purchaser, gives them a lot of power to set the terms of those contracts. And they have all the authority they need to do that. And they can mandate more than just $15 an hour. They can say that all of the things they buy have to be made in American factories and plants, which they did with a Buy American order. They can say that, all of the energy resources that we purchase or all of the fleet that we buy has to be clean energy or zero emissions, which they did today, actually, with a climate-based order. They can even go further than that. They can say that, you know, all federal contractors can't use arbitration agreements against their workers. They can say that they all have to have sick days. They can say that they have to allow their workers to engage in collective bargaining. There is a lot of power in the procurement space, and it's very good that Biden has kicked this off with a few ideas to use that to leverage some policies that he wants. So I mean, I'm pretty positive on that part for as far as Biden's goes.
And then can you talk about vaccines? Talk about Amy Goodman.
David Dan, talk about vaccines.
The very Amy Goodman setup. So yeah, I mean, the vaccine rollout certainly got off to a bumpy start. Federal government under Trump just sort of dropped a bunch of vaccine in the laps of the states and said, you go deal with it. There was no real federal coordination to get the vaccine out across the country. A lot of state health departments tried to go through hospitals to administer the vaccine, and hospitals were a little bit busy, like trying to keep people from dying during the pandemic. Like throwing a mass immunization campaign on top of that was not really advisable. But this has improved in the states. They've figured out some systems here. Biden came in with an idea that we would do 100 million shots. That's not 100 million people, but 100 million doses in 100 days, in his first 100 days. And we're above that rate right now. We're tracking at about 1.2 million shots per day over the last week, which is more than, you know, the 1 million a day that he needs on his benchmark. The issue that we're going to run up against is, are we going to have enough vaccine?
Yeah.
So states are starting to exhaust their supply. There are promises from the two major vaccine companies, Moderna and Pfizer, that they're going to get vaccine to the United States as per their promises. But there's some question as to whether they're going to actually be able to make that. The thing that's new is that the White House has said they're exploring options of just having other manufacturers use the Pfizer and Moderna ingredient list and just make the vaccine.
Why not?
And they can force that under, using the Defense Production Act.
Yeah.
They can force companies to and compel companies to produce already existing vaccines. And they should have probably been doing this months and months ago so that we'd have enough right now to expand the rollout, because, you know, any day that we get closer to normalcy is just incalculable in terms of the public health and in terms of the economy. I mean, if you can open restaurants a week earlier. So I think the problem is that one very interesting thing here that I see is there was one federal program that was really left to large chain pharmacies to do, and that was vaccinating people in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. There was this partnership that they did with between the government and CVS and Walgreens, and they were supposed to get everything vaccinated. There's only one state that opted out of this partnership with the big chains, and it was West Virginia. And West Virginia said, well, we don't really have enough CVS and Walgreens in our state to do this program with them. But we do have this network of independent small chain pharmacies that work with assisted living facilities. So we kind of have a natural experiment. Does big business have these economies of scale and are able to, you know, get things done quickly? Or do these smaller, more distributed networks have the ability? Well, West Virginia got everybody in the state in an assisted living facility to get a vaccine about a month before CVS and Walgreens started to go out to these assisted living facilities because there's so much bureaucracy. And it just like puts the lie to 40 years of having it rammed into our head that bigger is better, that economies of scale create these wondrous opportunities to distribute things all across the country and the world. And here in little West Virginia, which is not exactly a liberal bastion, they figured out a way to do this without the participation of CVS and Walgreens, and they did it much, much better.
Shouldn't there be a demand that for just, I mean, the Defense Production Act, what could people do to demand that kind of like go into effect? And also, isn't it time to just force these companies to produce this for free now? I mean, if there's ever anything that we can kind of scare people about, can it just be, what do we have to do? Like, this is such an emergency. And isn't this the time to kind of force the like Jonah Salk discussion of patents and owning the sun? And
I mean, here's the thing that's so interesting. So the federal government essentially paid or the R&D for these vaccines. The U.S. directly through Moderna, they picked up all the R&D. With Pfizer, they had a partner called BioNTech, which got most of its money from the German government. And then the U.S. did these purchase guarantees. They said, well, you know, if you develop this vaccine, we're going to buy 100 million doses or 200 million doses.
At X price. And so,
at X price. And so, you know, the combination of that took a pharmaceutical system that is usually very protracted and it has very long timelines. I don't know if we can invest this money or we're going to see a return, blah, blah, blah. And it accelerated it to the point that almost not even a year after this pandemic begins, we have a vaccine, which is incredible. But what it should do is it should cause a rethink of the entire process by which we create, develop, and distribute medications in the United States. This patent system that we have, the fact that there's a patent for things that the U.S. paid for and developed and guaranteed is absolutely ridiculous. And this is a huge problem in the developing world. I mean, rich countries can buy enough vaccine for their citizens, they can get it out. In the developing world, almost no vaccines have been distributed because they don't have the purchasing power. So they're last in line. They can't make generic alternatives through their own manufacturing facilities because there's patent protection. Now, Moderna has said, oh, well, we will allow this patent protection. You know, we will give these patents anywhere to anyone who needs them, but they're not giving like key bits of the ingredient lists and things like that could actually be used to create the stuff. And we see this all the time where the developing world needs, you know, HIV drugs. And the U.S. says, no, you can't make any generics because that would rob, you know, our domestic manufacturers from the possibility of profiting. So it really should cause a rethink of this entire system.
Yeah.
Why are we relying on private interests that are slow, that use public money anyway to create all of these, you know, innovations that are life-saving when we have a model now of the federal government being very muscular and getting these things done in a rapid amount of time.
Right. And it's like, it's so craven. And I get it when it's something like, I mean, it's not justifiable, obviously, in my opinion, morally or ethically, when it's anything, when it's HIV or anything, but like when it's a global pandemic, like, this is a global issue. Like, sure, people have different layers of privilege, right, and access to medical care. And if you're like not homeless, and if you can afford to, you know, this is one of these things. It's not a great equalizer, but they're also, you're not totally immune, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that go into account. But like, how do people not, even these rich, greedy people who are okay with human suffering, don't they care at all about like protecting themselves from this human suffering, or are they just that?
Look, yeah, in a connected world, you're going to need the protections extended to everybody on the planet if they're going to be truly effective, number one. Number two, even if you look at it in a craven capitalist way, like countries that are effectively shut down because they don't have access to this vaccine aren't trading partners, right? I mean, you're not going to be able to get your goods in there. And you're not able to hit the profit margins that you normally hit in these developing countries.
You can't exploit people, you know, if they're dying.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I mean, any way that you look at this, it is a public good to inoculate the planet and to take whatever steps necessary. And those steps don't include, you know, making sure that you're maximizing your patent resource so that, you know, India isn't, you know, distributing this vaccine without you getting a little take of it.
Yeah. And one last thing for me, I just wanted to follow up on a story that you did last year, right at the start of the CARES Act, which was, and I it was really interesting how this all worked out in the end. When they first announced the eviction moratorium, you started hearing from homeowners that mortgage servicers were telling them to skip their forbearance programs. Basically, it was because the bailout initially was kind of poorly designed and would have put these kind of collection agency type companies that didn't have a lot of capital, put them on the hook for making like a year's worth of payments to mortgage bond holders. And so rather than do that, they tried to force homeowners to take the cost on themselves. How did that all work out in the end? Are they still having problems with that? Because it's not as simple as just telling people you don't have to pay your rent anymore. There's a whole process that has to be gone through. And did they actually come up with a system that works?
Well, there are still people in forbearance programs. There are still, barriers on foreclosure, particularly from, mortgages that are held publicly or quasi publicly by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or things like that. The system is still kind of working in that sense. These mortgage companies that, their job is just take money and give it out to investors. They're in an environment where there is a lot of mortgage forbearance. They just don't have the capital to give it out. And they're supposed to advance this money over and then take it all on their books. That's been a kind of a dangerous environment. And some of this has been lifted because we ended up propping up the stock market so much that people weren't as in bad trouble as anticipated. And also what we've seen is that this has been a very uneven recovery where people that make in the top 10% of the income earners have almost no employment loss, whereas most of the employment loss is at the low end. And of course, when you're talking about homeowners, you're talking about people in a relatively high end of the income scale. So there hasn't been as much of a widespread problem with housing as anticipated. And of course, we've seen a housing boom in terms of purchases, second homes, homes in different areas that are cheaper but more desirable because of working from home changes. So the housing market has actually been pretty good. So that's something that wasn't necessarily anticipated at the beginning of this cycle. So I think mortgage servicers have been able to sort of work their way through it because of all these other factors.
And just a quick related question. Like I saw, semi-related, the year-end results for the investment banks last year were insane. Like I think they posted something like $120 billion in profits, the biggest banks. And a lot of that had to do with something that should have been obvious to everybody at the beginning of this sort of Fed-inspired rally, which is that there was this huge boom in underwriting fees. So basically, all this new debt issuance that's driven by Fed spending, it's like a gigantic subsidy for all these Wall Street companies. And I mean, I'm wondering if you're thinking what I'm thinking, which is that, we're going to have a repeat after 2008 when kind of the bailout driven inflation of the economy sort of accelerated income inequality. I mean, are we going to have that same thing happen again after this?
Well, first thing I'm thinking is the Robin Hood guys need to get to work. Like, I'm the shorts in those banks. The second thing is that, yes, what we've seen in this pandemic and the recovery has been an absolute stratification of wealth and income, and an even much further than where we were even before the pandemic, which was very, very high in terms of income inequality. It's gotten much, much worse. I wrote a piece that I called Social Distancing about this distance that the rich are putting themselves in away from.
Yeah, they like lapped them, right? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely crazy. And not even just economically, but physically. Like, there are all these talk of purchases of luxury bunkers or like different.
That's why they think that it's okay to do what they're doing with the vaccines.
Right. Fortresses in New Zealand and weird things where they're literally separating themselves from the rest of society. Right. So, that's just recapitulated in this economic inequality. And what's going to be the effect of that? Yeah. I mean, the fact that this mania can happen in the markets is indicative of some level of frothiness, right?
Right. So, of course.
There's a whole other thing that's going on in the markets, which are these, and I don't want to get into a very technical subject at the end of this conversation, but there's these things called SPACs, these mm-hmm. special purpose acquisition companies. And all you have to know is it's a rich person that says, hey, give me a lot of money and I'll go buy a company. And it's an evasion of the normal disclosures that a company would have to make if they go public. Instead, they just get bought by a company that's already public, even though it's not a company. They're literally called blank check companies. They are companies that don't exist. They exist only to purchase private companies
and get around the reporting.
Correct. So there were more SPACs created in the first 3 weeks of this year than there were in all of 2019. It's absolutely nuts. This and this is another level of just a lot of money with nothing to do, like just chasing stuff. And that's what ultimately, I mean, when you get down to it, that's what the financial crisis was about, right? It was, we have a lot of money. We don't know what to do with it. Housing looks good. Let's just throw a lot of money into housing and see what happens. Today, there's a lot of money. Let's throw it into going on a spending spree and buying up a bunch of companies or, you know, corporate debt or, you know, it's a few different markets. It's not quite at the same level of housing because with housing, you have the sort of leverage that you get from buying a mortgage that's much higher. But it is concerning. I mean, I do think that, you know, when you see crazy things happen in the market, usually there's something going on behind the scenes that is not great. And there's you know, a sort of Wile E. Coyote off the cliff quality to it, where as soon as they look down, they're going to realize that they have to fall. Right. You know, there's that, that's certainly there, I think, in our economy. But you know, the question is, we've now established, not just through this recovery, but through previous ones, that the federal government has an interest in not letting any rich person suffer any consequences from any kind of recession, whether they induce it or not. You know, the question is, you know, will extraordinary steps be taken once again to ensure that the potential consequences of the kind of thing you're talking about doesn't happen?
Won't the natural outcome of all of this be just widening public discontent as people start to figure out that this recovery, basically, if you own financial assets, you're doing well, and if you don't, you're getting the short end of the stick, and the stick is very short during the COVID period, right? People are really suffering. They're having a really hard time. I mean, right now, it feels like people just can't see that difference as much. But aren't they going to figure that out eventually?
I think that's certainly the traditional way that you would look at something like this, that you're setting yourself up for massive social unrest. If you have a society that is so, you know, stratified. I think in some way, like what's happening with this Robin Hood stuff is a reaction to this, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, well, what we figured out is that you have to be in the markets. These guys in the markets are getting absolutely rich and they're destroying everything else in their path. Let's get together and screw them over a bit. And that's what's happening. I mean, it might not be at a conscious level, but that's sort of under the surface. That's kind of what's happening. So that's an interesting and unexpected way a side effect of what's happening. Do you remember in I think it was 2005, 2006, something like that, Citigroup put out this research note where they described the United States as a plutonomy, it was an economy basically so ruled by the rich that nobody else within the economy as a participant actually mattered. That as long as the rich were, you know, buying luxury goods and you know, hiring servants and things like that, that everything else would take care of itself. It was a research note to companies saying, well, what you really need to focus on are things that rich people like, because, you know, focusing on staples, that's only going to get you so far, but it's only the rich people that have the purchasing power. So what you're going to have to do is make products that rich people.
I don't remember that one. Jeez. Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of the thoughts about, well, you know, if the vaccine hits, we're going to have this big recovery, and there's a lot of pent-up demand for, you know, people aren't going to restaurants, they aren't going to music venues, they aren't going to theater or movies, and there's going to be just this rush, and there's going to be a big economic boom in the second half of this year. That's what you hear from a lot of economic analysts. That is kind of wedded to this idea of a plutonomy. Right? Because that's who has the money and that's who has the pent-up demand and the ability to spend it. But there's like this whole other, if you look outside the aggregate, there's this whole other class of people that have really, really suffered during this pandemic. And you're relying on like a bizarre version of trickle down to think that they're going to be the beneficiaries of this alleged economic boom because rich people want to go have cocktails again.
Yeah, that's kind of the Larry Summers way of thinking about it, right? Like you have all this, our potential spending is outweighing our ability to spend right now. So that's why we're not really having a problem, right? But that's only true for a few people, actually. But.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the tyranny of aggregates sometimes, you know.
Right.
You could call it. You know, what's going to happen? I think there's the potential for social unrest. There's been a little less than I expected, but of course, you know, everyone's been cooped up inside, and it has kind of lashed out in ways. I mean, I think the George Floyd protests have something to do with this. That there was massive anger at a system. It may not have been directed specifically at Wall Street or anything like that, but there was this sort of massive anger, and it played out in that fashion. And I think the Robinhood thing is another component of this. So, you know, it's obviously I didn't see that one coming, so I'm not going to say exactly what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting.
Desperation absolutely breeds unrest. And, you know, one thing we've seen in the last year is unrest. I mean, maybe it hasn't been targeted exactly at who you think it should be targeted.
Yeah, that's what we need to do. We need to redirect it.
From Minneapolis to the Capitol, we've sure seen some unrest.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, typically, when you look at countries that have this massive gap between the rich and poor, that's what you get. And
yeah.
We should just tell everybody, issue a memo on both sides that everybody should just go to Melvin Capital. That's where they should be. They should buy up GameStop. That's what they should do. Anyway, David, thank you so much.
Yeah, David, this is amazing. Yeah.
For coming on.
Talked to you for hours now.
And we'd love to have you on. You know, I'd love to at some point talk about your last two books too. So sorry to spend so much time on GameStop this time.
Monopolize. You didn't give a shout out to Monopolize. Chain of Title.
Absolutely.
We each have our favorite kids. I prefer Monopolize. He prefers Chain of Title.
Right. Exactly.
But we love them both. Yeah.
We'll talk about both your kids next time.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. That was great. Love David Dayan.
You're a very smart guy. Really knows what he's talking about. And you know, he always gets to that next level of like granular detail on all these things that, you know, most of us don't do. So that's great.
I only do it because I don't have the time. I hold back a lot.
Right.
Matt, you don't
exactly.
know.
Exactly. You just don't want to embarrass your audience.
I get
that. That was great. Now I'm going to go have a tooth ripped out. So that's not so fun.
Well, thank you guys so much for watching, for listening. Make sure you like, subscribe, hit the subscribe, then hit the bell. And a shout out to our producer, Daniel Halperin, and also Sheermag for the theme song. Make sure you rate and review on wherever you listen to your podcasts.
That's right. And don't do anything else except listen to
us.
Yep. Stay exactly in one place. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks. Bye.